Come on up, Terry. We often have our board president participate in our new member welcome. He's under the weather today, so I'll be standing in for him. This is Terry Zapataki, our membership committee chair. Besides Jerry not feeling well, Ann Oust has been running a fever and can't make it. And so, Gary, I've asked you to record this so that she can listen to the podcast, right, Gary Rulipa? All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. We recently held an exploring membership class and welcomed three new people into our membership in our congregation. Today, it is our privilege to welcome some new people as members of this church. We will also be welcoming back two returning members, who I don't see here either.
Attendance is not mandatory. Renee Noel Felice writes, membership is not something conferred upon one person by an already static group of others, but a covenant among individuals to become something new. When we welcome new members into the congregation, we are agreeing to be changed by their presence and gifts, by their experiences and truths. This is what allows our community to be an organic, living, changing body. And this is the promise of community, for it means that no matter how long or how brief we have been a member of this community, it always has the power to teach us and transform us. It means that together we are able to create in this community a place of learning, of growth, of hope, and shared strength. Together, we can create a place and in ourselves a people stronger and greater than we are alone.
Today, it is my honor to introduce our new and returning members to you. Please stand as I read your name and remain standing so that we can welcome you with a round of applause. Ann Oust, who can't be here. Jeanette Davey. Linda Thompson, and Barb and Paul Verko, who are returning members.
Please stay standing.
Today, as we welcome our new members, will you, the rest of you, join me in saying to them, welcome.
Welcome. Welcome.
We covenant with you.
We covenant with you.
Some of you remember that we have a community weaving that we made to symbolize the different strands and colors and wonderful qualities of all the people who belong to our community. We'll put this back up after our paintings, our display of paintings is taken down in a couple of weeks, but I invite new members to join me in my office to add their ribbon to this after the service.
Thank you, Sue, and good morning, everyone. We know that February is Black History Month, and we know or should know that tomorrow, February 12th, is Abe Lincoln's birthday. Still looking good after 209 years, Abe Lincoln. Got my button here, Lincoln, supporting him this election cycle. In honor of those two things, I'd like to talk about the infamous Dred Scott decision. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Some of you are thinking probably what a lot of law school students think when the professor starts talking, "Oh, Lord, professor, don't call on me. I haven't read that case." Dred Scott. Well, let me talk to you about it. On April 6th, 1846, an enslaved married couple, Dred Scott and Harriet Scott, filed petitions in Missouri State Court seeking their freedom. Now, Missouri was a slave state at the time, but the law was on their side. Dred Scott's owner had taken him from Missouri to Illinois, a free state, and then to free territory. And Harriet Scott, separately, had been taken by her owner from Virginia to Pennsylvania, a free state, and then to free territory. Dred and Harriet were married in free territory, where they had met, and Dred's owner, a doctor named Emerson, became Harriet's owner. After various travels, the Scots eventually were taken to Missouri. And after Emerson died, the Scots continued to be held in bondage by Emerson's widow. Now, the lawsuit that the Scots filed relied on two legal principles that were long established in Missouri and elsewhere. There really wasn't any question about these principles. First, a slave owner who takes a slave into a free state or a free territory thereby frees that slave. And second, once free, a person was forever free. If you take that freed person back into slave territory or a slave state, you don't make that person a slave again. The Scots won in the trial court, in Missouri State Court, but they lost on appeal. A newly elected majority of the Missouri Supreme Court overturned settled law and held that the status of slavery reattached to them once they came back to slave territory. No longer was it once free, forever free. Now, the next year, in 1853, after the state court decision was reached, the Scots then went to federal court, and they sued a gentleman named John Sanford, who was Mrs. Emerson's brother, who made some claim to ownership of the Scots. Sanford lived in New York, technically. He had a place in Missouri, but he had his legal residence in New York State. And the case was filed in federal court on a theory of what's called diversity of citizenship. And that is based on a provision of the Constitution that says, the judicial power, that is, of the federal government, shall extend to controversies between citizens of different states. After a trial in federal court, which, by the way, the Scots lost, the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court was headed by Chief Justice Roger B. Taney. Dred Scott versus Sanford was decided by a 7-2 majority on March 6, 1857. Chief Justice Taney wrote the lead opinion, the one that has been taken ever since as the opinion of the court. That opinion has been called the worst atrocity in the Supreme Court's history. And the name of the case itself has become a convenient epithet. You don't like something the Supreme Court has done, all you have to do is call it a new Dred Scott. That is the worst condemnation that is conceivable for any judicial decision. Dred Scott held that under the Constitution, African Americans, whether they were slave or free, were not and they could not be citizens of the U.S. Chief Justice Taney used words of profound ugliness that really are hard to read. I'm going to have a hard time reading these. You're going to have a hard time listening to them. But this is what is contained, among other things, in the official record of the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. This is what he said. They, and he meant African Americans, they had for more than a century before the adoption of the Constitution been regarded as beings of an inferior order, and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. Now, no citizenship for the Scots meant no diversity of citizenship under the Constitution, and that meant no jurisdiction for the federal court. Now, Tani should have ended there. He shouldn't even have gone there, but having gone there, he should have ended there, because if you have no jurisdiction, you're supposed to stop. You have no jurisdiction. Don't keep talking. But he didn't stop there. He went on to say that Congress lacked any authority to forbid slavery in any of the federal territories. And what that meant is that of almost 1.5 million square miles of federal territorial lands that existed in 1857, not a single square inch of it could be saved from slavery. And there were nearly 4 million enslaved Americans in 1857, and there were almost 500,000 free African Americans. And Taney's opinion judicially banished every single one of them from the American civic and political community. You know, practically everything that could have been wrong with Taney's opinion was wrong with it. And just a minor example, but it is symptomatic, the decision even got the name of one of the parties wrong. Dred Scott was hailed in the South. He was hailed by Southern sympathizers in the North. It was, of course, denounced in much of the North. Frederick Douglass, who was an anti-slavery orator and former slave, said this: "The Supreme Court is not the only power in this world. The Supreme Court of the Almighty is greater. Judge Taney can do many things, but he cannot perform impossibilities. He cannot reverse the decision of the Most High. He cannot change the essential nature of things, making evil good and good evil. Happily for the whole human family, their rights have been defined, declared, and decided in a court higher than the Supreme Court." But of course, many anti-slavery people in this country were far more worried about the actions of the earthly court in the here and now than they were about the actions of the heavenly court in the by and by. Abraham Lincoln, who was campaigning for the U.S. Senate in 1858 in Illinois, objected to Dred Scott on the grounds that that decision, by its logic, if you want to call it that, might forbid states like Illinois from outlawing slavery. Lincoln argued that Dred Scott said that the right of a white person to hold a black person in slavery was distinctly and expressly affirmed in the Constitution. And because a state cannot destroy a right that is so protected, therefore, no state could forbid slavery. In other words, if that logic held, freedom itself could have been forbidden under the Constitution, and Illinois could become a slave state overnight. Now, it can never be known whether the Supreme Court would have gone as far as this. Chief Justice Taney never got the chance to decide Dred Scott 2.0, thank goodness. And at the time that Dred Scott was decided, nobody knew that it would come to be what one scholar later called the most frequently overturned decision in history. There are many entries on the list of repudiations of Dred Scott. One of the ways it was repudiated in effect was simply being ignored by the Lincoln administration, which came into power in 1861, 4 years afterwards. On Inauguration Day, 1861, Taney, who swore Lincoln in, had to sit and listen to Lincoln as he all but promised to act as if Dred Scott did not exist. And that's the way his administration acted. During the first year of the Lincoln administration, his Secretary of State granted an American passport to an African American who was described in that passport as a citizen of the United States. And in 1862, Congress passed and Lincoln signed laws forbidding slavery in the territories and in the District of Columbia. And later on that same year, Lincoln's Attorney General issued an opinion declaring that free African Americans were indeed citizens of the U.S. And then, of course, there was that whole Emancipation Proclamation thing, which Lincoln could not have ordered if he'd paid any attention to Dred Scott. Dred Scott was also repudiated by the three Civil War amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which were enacted within 5 years of the end of the Civil War in 1865. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment, which we tend to think of as the amendment that guarantees due process of law and equal protection of the laws, and it does do that, it also directly overruled Dred Scott by granting citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And the 15th Amendment guaranteed all citizens of the U.S. the right to vote, regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And Dred Scott was also repudiated by an action of the Supreme Court itself, which was made possible by the death of Chief Justice Taney. Taney had turned 80 years of age within weeks of his decision in Dred Scott. He held on to his position as Chief Justice after the start of the Civil War, even though he was a Confederate sympathizer. In the language of the time, he was a copperhead. And he remained in that state of mind until his death in October of 1864. You know, it's said that nobody should speak ill of the dead, but there were many Union sympathizers who forgot that rule when they learned that Taney had died. A New York lawyer, George Templeton Strong, wrote in his diary, "The honorable old Roger B. Taney has earned the gratitude of his country by dying at last." Better late than never. Lincoln appointed Salmon B. Chase, his former Secretary of the Treasury, to replace Taney. Chase had relatively advanced racial views. As a lawyer in Ohio before the war, he had spent many, many long hours representing runaway slaves. Chase's appointment gave hope to an African American named John Rock, and I've talked about John Rock before. John Rock was then living in Massachusetts. Rock had an amazing resume. He was a dentist. He was a physician, an activist, an orator, and he was a lawyer. He wanted to become the first African American admitted to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court. And for that purpose, he enlisted the help of Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner. On January 31, 1865, the U.S. House of Representatives approved the 13th Amendment to the Constitution outlawing slavery. And John Rock was there in the House chamber to witness that vote. On the next day, February 1st, he appeared before the Supreme Court in the old Senate chamber where it was located at the time, to be admitted to practice. And going back to the diary of George Templeton Strong, this is what Strong wrote about that astonishing event. "Here has the Supreme Court of the United States just been admitting a colored person, one of its attorneys and counselors, on motion of Charles Sumner. I can scarce believe the evening papers. The dust that was Roger B. Taney must have shivered in its tomb." There's something else about that swearing-in ceremony on February 1st of 1865 that I think is worth noting. And we know about this because of Chief Justice Chase's own diary. His diary entry for that day, February 1st, says this. He said, "Went to Capitol, told that Sumner was in the courtroom with colored lawyer, whose admission he was about to move. When judges seated, Sumner made the motion, and I introduced Mr. Rock. I recognized the introduction as usual and said, "The clerk will administer the oath to Mr. Rock." He then introduced Mr. Balch, whom I took to be another colored man. I recognized him also and said, "Mr. Balch will proceed to the clerk's desk and be qualified." I purposely avoided the slightest deviation from my usual formula in admitting whites. Then he adds this, "Mr. Balch was, as I learned, a white man." Now, only 8 years before this, Chief Justice Taney had been desperate to read into the Constitution a distinction between white and black Americans. And yet, on February 1st of 1865, Taney's successor as Chief Justice was introduced to two people in the same place, at the same time, and for really the same reason. And he didn't see any racial distinction between the two. He was at that time quite literally colorblind, one of the few people about whom that can be truthfully said. Now, Chase might have been colorblind, but there was at least one other person in the courtroom who was not. That was Daniel Wesley Middleton, the clerk of the Supreme Court. He was a holdover from the Taney era. Middleton, yes, he administered the oath that he was ordered to administer, but he wouldn't even look at Rock. He looked only in the direction of the other lawyer who was admitted on that day, a man named Francis Vernes Balch. Middleton knew that Balch was a white guy, even if Chase didn't. Let me tell you about Balch. Francis Balch was a young lawyer from Boston. He was a Civil War veteran who had served as personal secretary to Senator Sumner. We might today say executive assistant or chief of staff, but they called it personal secretary at the time. And for all his life, Vernes thought of Sumner as a truly great man. You know, it's a big deal for a young lawyer to be admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a big deal. And if you can arrange things, you want them to be arranged just right. And Balch could have been admitted to practice on, well, just about any other day. But he picked that day, February 1st, 1865. You know, it's quite possible that Balch knew Rock personally. But even if he didn't know him personally, he definitely knew him by reputation and through correspondence. Because, after all, Balch had been Sumner's secretary. He opened his mail. And whatever it was, to whatever extent that Balch knew about Rock, it was enough for Balch to decide that he wanted to be sworn in alongside Rock on that day. Now, two significant events happened on or within 2 years after Rock and Balch were sworn in. Sadly, John Rock, who never was in good physical health at all, he died in December of 1866. He never got the chance to argue a case in the Supreme Court. But on a happier note, in January of 1867, Frances Balch and Ellen Noyes Balch had a daughter. Her name was Emily Green Balch. Emily Balch lived from 1867 to 1961, 94 years. She was a social worker, and then she was a professor of economics and sociology at Wellesley College. She was an activist. She worked primarily with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, an organization that she helped to found in 1915 and which still exists to this day. In 1946, at the age of 79, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She was only the second woman to be awarded that prize. The first was her friend and fellow activist, Jane Addams. Emily Balch started out as a Unitarian, just like a lot of other privileged Bostonians, including her parents. But as an adult, she became a Quaker. She believed in peace. She believed in true fellowship among all people. A few years before she won the Nobel, while the Second World War was still raging, this was in late 1942, Emily Balch wrote a letter to the president of the World Jewish Congress about the horrors facing Jews in Europe. And keep in mind, not all those horrors had even happened yet. And those that had happened, not everyone knew about. But she knew enough to know that they were horrors. She expressed sorrow that the world had not tried to deal with those horrors until it was too late to do anything except respond with what she called reciprocal slaughter and destruction. This is part of her letter. She said, when matters had reached a point where prevention of these wrongs was no longer possible, we might still have done far more to alleviate them than we have done. We have been far too ununderstanding, cold-hearted, and self-regarding. Neither have we kept ourselves clean of the contagion of the destructive feeling of race prejudice. Nostra culpa, nostra maxima culpa, our fault, our most grievous fault. And she went on. Even in this dark hour, we can believe, or if we cannot believe, we can hope that in spite of everything, we are on our way to liberation from race prejudice, and that the day is coming when such cruelties as those now going on in Poland and elsewhere may be unthinkable. And we cannot merely hope, we can work actively in many ways to bring that day nearer. She signed it, yours in deepest fellow feeling, Emily G. Balch. And maybe it's because I've been thinking about and living with the decision of Dred Scott for a long time, but that letter sounds a lot to me like Emily Balch arguing against Dred Scott. Emily, the daughter of Francis, would have known the pertinent history. Emily and her father were very, very close. They wrote to each other a great deal. Emily was 31 years of age when her father died, and she lived for another 63 years after that point. She kept all of his letters, all of her life. When she died, they were all there in a box. He loved her. He was proud of her and made sure she knew how proud he was in a kind of restrained, proper Bostonian sort of way. She plainly adored him. He would have told her about his swearing in and about Dr. Rock and about what that meant at the time it happened. And Emily Balch, the sociologist, would have known, and I'm sure did know, that there are always disfavored groups of people whom the dominant privileged groups look upon as having no rights the privileged have any reason to respect. And there's no lack of spokespeople for the dominant privileged groups who give voice to those ugly themes that we saw sounded 161 years ago in the Dred Scott decision. Those themes are still being sounded today. We keep hearing them. They're all around us all the time. Charles Evans Hughes, he was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court from 1930 to 41. He once called the Dred Scott decision a self-inflicted wound, and he meant that in kind of a limited institutional sense, that it was the court hurting the court, and he was right, of course. But his description applies far more broadly than I think he intended. In Dred Scott, one of the three branches of the American government, led by its chief, inflicted a grievous wound upon the rest of America. And so what that really means is we Americans did this to ourselves. And we keep on doing it, you know. Whenever we treat other human beings as creatures of a lower order, or when we allow our leaders to do that without holding them to account, then we reopen that wound, that grievous wound. And I called this the many repudiations of Dred Scott. It's not enough to repudiate Dred Scott once or twice or three times or four times. We have to keep repudiating it over and over and over. Someday there might come a time when Dred Scott will stay in its grave, when no further repudiation of that decision will be required. We may not be able to bring ourselves to expect that that day is going to come, but we do have the right to hope for it. And not merely a right to hope for it, but as Emily Balch told us, an obligation to work actively to bring that day nearer. Nostra culpa, nostra maxima culpa. And now, let's have an offering.